Welcome to this very late episode of Coffin Cast. My name is Kristen. Welcome. If this is your first episode, stop. Seriously, stop. Just stop. Go to the beginning. So you know what you're in for, to make sure you enjoy it. If this is not your first episode, thank you so much for listening. It means more to me than I can ever express. So, sorry this is late. I know I do it Fridays at midnight, and it was supposed to be out. I know I said that I was going to put it out Saturday at midnight, but as I stated, I had an emotional break, and I needed to breathe. So, I did. And I'm totally late on getting this out, so I apologize. Also, the beginning of this week, I started a completely different story than what I'm presenting to you. So for once, I'll be ahead of the game, and I'll have it recorded before too long. Yay! For once, I'm on time. But the reason I chose to change the story is because this is Pride Month. We just had the Austin Pride Parade. I'm from Austin, or the Austin area. Just had it yesterday. I've been watching this show that I've become obsessed with that I recommend to everybody. It's on FX and Netflix if you don't have anything you can live stream from. It's called Pose. It's about the 1980s ballroom scene, not ballroom as in waltz, etc. It's like voguing and things like that. Young gay black men and trans women of color, you know, and what they went through as AIDS was becoming more of an epidemic and the struggles they went through daily life. And I thought about, you know, the first story that I heard that really drove home what day-to-day was like for gay people in our country. And just to put this out there, I grew up, you know, I was born in the early 80s. I grew up in a tiny Texas town, pretty conservative, that, you know, I didn't know anything about gay people. I didn't know gay people existed. I didn't know anything about HIV or AIDS. They didn't talk about it in my town until Magic Johnson got HIV. Then it became more like, okay, this is a discussion we need to have. Luckily, the school I went to didn't try to scare us. They didn't say, oh, you'll get AIDS from touching people or breathing the same air. They let us know that that wasn't the case. So I appreciate that. But they didn't say how it was transmitted because we were kids. We were like in early elementary school. They didn't say, oh, you get it by having sex. They didn't even say that only gay people get it. They said, you know, that it can happen to anyone by transferring blood or fluids, but they didn't go into detail, of course. So, I moved from a small town in Texas to the California Bay Area, just outside of San Francisco, at the age of 12. Holy cow, it was a culture shock. There were kids my age at my junior high that were gay and open and out about it. I had teachers that were gay. You know, I experienced going to San Francisco for the first time and seeing, you know, rainbow flags everywhere and gay men holding hands, and it became the norm for me, and I'm glad that it did. I'm glad I wasn't stuck here in this tiny little town. You know, and I think that having that experience of moving and having that culture shock really molded me into the person that I am now. I'd like to consider myself an ally. I probably could do more to be an ally, absolutely. But, you know, it helped mold me as a person, and I appreciate that a lot. So, with that, the story I'm doing this week has to do with somebody from San Francisco who had possibly, hasn't totally been proven. It's more of a, I don't want to say that this was a hate crime, but I'm sure it had something to do with it. But it was something that was part of San Francisco's history and a big part of their history. So the story I'm doing today is on Harvey Milk. And I'm calling this episode, for lack of a better idea, I'm calling it the Twinkie Defense. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and introduce you to Mr. Harvey Milk. Harvey Milk was born May 22nd, 1930 in New York City. In school, he played football and had a passion for the opera. He graduated with a degree in mathematics from New York State College for Teachers at Albany. He joined the Navy during the Korean War, and he was honorably discharged in 1955. From there, he did become a mathematics teacher. He had various other jobs, such as an actuary statistician. If I say that correctly, it'll be a miracle. Statistician? I don't know. We'll just go with that. That sounds good. Okay. For an insurance company and a campaign aide for conservative Republican Barry Goldwater's 1964 presidential campaign. So, Harvey was a pretty conservative guy who just happened to be gay. He had a few lovers at this point, but was largely still in the closet with his family and whatnot. He had moved around from New York to Texas to California and then back to New York, where he ended up working as an aide at a theater where he was introduced to flower children and hippies and all that good stuff. And the cast ended up chipping away at his conservative persona. He started to grow his hair out long. He grew a mustache and a beard and put on jeans and began to live in New York City as an out gay man. There he met his long-term boyfriend, Scott Smith, and the two ended up moving to the Castro District, in San Francisco, opening a camera shop. And it is here, in San Francisco, that the tragedy begins to unfold. It was in this camera shop where Harvey realized he needed to do something. One day in 1973, a state bureaucrat entered Milk's shop, Castro Camera, and informed him that he owed $100 as a deposit against state sales tax. I don't know what that means, but I'm guessing it's not necessary. Doesn't sound like a real thing. It probably is. I don't know. Anyway, the two of them got into a shouting match, and Harvey ended up going to the man's office for weeks to complain. He ended up getting the fine reduced to $30, but was still seeing how messed up the city government was. He realized, quote, "I finally reached the point where I knew I had to become involved or shut up." His idea of becoming involved meant running for city supervisor. That's San Francisco's version of city council. They call them supervisor board or supervisor of blah, blah, blah. So it's the same as city council, essentially. There were challenges for Harvey from the start. Many gay politicians, donors, and bureaucrats in the area didn't really trust him. He kind of just showed up on the scene one day and wanted funds. He hadn't paid his dues. So, he lost the first election, but swept the Castro District and liberal neighborhoods, other liberal neighborhoods. Based on the districting at the time, if it had been districted, if the voting districts had been done correctly, he likely would have won. His media savvy and relationships with the working class and labor unions definitely got him noticed as somebody to watch out for politically. He became known as the mayor of Castro Street for his growing leadership among the businesses in the district. At this point, he decided it was time to become a more serious candidate. He cut his hair, shaved his mustache, and began to dress in suits. His shop, Castro Camera, became a hub for his campaigns, and in general, just a hangout for folks in the Castro. The Castro itself was becoming a place that could make or break elections, and Harvey, being the self-styled mayor of the Castro, was instrumental in influencing people's opinions on candidates. I could go on and on about Harvey's triumphs and failures, as there were many. We would be here all day, and I'm not going to do that to you. One of the ones that, the successes, excuse me, that I want to focus on is Harvey took on a conservative politician from Orange County named John Briggs, who wanted to make it illegal for gays and lesbians to work in California schools. The measure was defeated due to a lot of opposition. That opposition mainly came from the fact that Harvey Milk reached out to several powerful politicians and explained to them why this was a bad thing and how it would affect them, how it would affect gays and lesbians, etc. And he ended up getting the support of Gerald Ford, who was president, of course, Ronald Reagan, who was governor of California at that time, and of course his friend George Moscone. Harvey was, he was very charismatic. He was able to reach across, you know, lines to get people involved. He was, of course, great at galvanizing the gay community, but he also reached out to labor unions. He reached out to regular all-American families. He would make jokes, you know, self-deprecating jokes to try to put them at ease, to not be afraid of somebody who was different. And that's the kind of guy he was. He got people involved, and it didn't matter if they were gay or not. He got people involved and helped people see that things were not right, and treating people that way because of who they loved was wrong. So that's just a little bit of who Harvey Milk was, you know, to give you a better idea of how charismatic he was and how he could have become something amazing, more than he already was. He could have gone so far had he been allowed to. So, in the interest of keeping it short and on topic, because this is Coffin Cast, there's a tragedy coming. You know it's coming. I know it's coming. Let's just move on. Harvey finally, good for him, had a successful campaign for city supervisor, and he was elected. He made it on the board. His election made national headlines, and he walked arm in arm with his lover at the time, Jack Lira, in the pictures of him getting sworn in. It was all over the newspapers. It was all on the nightly news video of him walking arm in arm with his man. And, you know, it was a big deal. He was the first openly gay city supervisor for the city of San Francisco. It was a big deal. Now, just to kind of also give you an idea of who Mayor Moscone was, he campaigned on the side of getting people into city government that were not the norm. At the time, of course, not now, but at the time they were not the norm. He wanted a diverse city supervisory board. So sworn in with Milk was a single mother, Carol Ruth Silver, a Chinese American, Gordon Lau, and an African American woman, Ella Hill Hutch. And these were all first time things, or not, I don't want to say things. These were all firsts on the city supervisory board. Now, not so much the first. We have Daniel White, who's a Catholic, all-American dude with a young family, 32 years old, looks like a Ken doll, got that little chiseled chin and stuff. He was more the norm of what people were used to. Dan White was a police officer and a firefighter, and this was his first time in any kind of political role. So let's talk about Dan White a little bit. So, Dan White's record as a police officer was a bit spotty at best. He did get reprimanded for attacking a handcuffed assailant, but on the same token as a firefighter, he was hailed as a hero for saving a woman and a baby from a burning building. By all accounts, he was a man's man. He was 32 years old. Like, I think I said that already, but he was kind of young, good-looking guy, and what most people would look at as a stereotypical politician. That being said, he seemed to get along with everybody on the board, and specifically with Harvey Milk, which is interesting because Harvey Milk's a gay guy. Dan White's not. He's kind of a buff, you know, firefighter, police, Irish Catholic kind of guy. So the fact that even Harvey was like one of three people invited to his daughter's christening, that's a big deal. They seemed to get along pretty well. The fallout began when the Catholic Church in April of 1978 proposed a facility for juvenile offenders who had committed murder, arson, and rape in White's district. So, of course, his constituents aren't going to want that. So he opposed it, but everybody else on the city board agreed to it. So he saw this as the first spit in the face from everybody that he thought he could trust. This clash between people began kind of the downfall of Dan White and his friendship with people on the board, specifically, again, Harvey. And White had kind of a mixed record on gay rights. Like, he opposed the Briggs Initiative, which we discussed earlier, but he also voted against an ordinance that prohibited discrimination against gays in housing and employment. So after that clash, and many more, Dan ended up resigning from his seat on the supervisor board on November 10th, 1978, citing the pay, making it difficult to support his family, and he believed that the opposition against him by the other members was due to corruption. So 4 days later, because his constituents had reached out to him, they wanted him back, they lobbied to get him back, he ended up meeting with Mayor Moscone, who at first kind of said he would think about it, he would see if he could get him back on the board. But after talking to all the other board members, again including Harvey, they basically asked that Dan White not be reinstated. Nobody liked him anymore. So this is where things start to get a bit dicey. On November 27th, Dan White entered the San Francisco City Hall through a first floor window to avoid being forced to go through the newly installed metal detectors. He walked into Mayor Moscone's office first and asked him once again, please reconsider reinstating me into my office. Moscone very gently told him, no, I can't do that. And he gave him other options. To answer to that, Dan White pulled out a gun and shot Mayor Moscone in his shoulder, his chest, and twice in his head. Shortly thereafter, he walks across the hall to Harvey Milk's office and asks him, hey, come meet me in my old office. Let's have a talk. Let's talk this out. As soon as they get in there, Harvey goes in first. Dan White pulls his gun out again, and Harvey reaches up his hand to kind of shield himself. Unfortunately, that's not going to work. And first, he shot through his hand. Second, he shot him in both shoulders. And as Harvey collapsed on the floor, Dan White put his gun to his head and shot him in the back of the head twice, killing him, of course, instantly. Both Mayor Moscone and Harvey Milk were killed instantly. Dan White left City Hall. He escaped without getting caught. While the building began to grow in panic because there were two dead men in there now, and people were freaking out because they heard gunshots, they didn't know what happened. He ended up escaping easily. He went to a payphone, called his wife, and they met at a church, where after talking for a couple hours, they both decided that he needed to turn himself in. He went to his old station, and on duty that night was a friend of his, Frank Falzon, and he was the detective that took his statement. Dan sobbed, was very emotional, and told him everything. He said that he was experiencing paranoia from Moscone telling the press that he wasn't a good supervisor. He felt that everyone on the board was against him. Not only did he kill Harvey Milk and George Moscone, he also intended to kill two more people. Falzon quoted White as saying, "I was on a mission. I wanted four of them. Carol Ruth Silver, she was the biggest snake, and Willie Brown, he was masterminding the whole thing." The trial began, and at the trial, White's defense, they argued that his mental state at the time of the killings was one of kind of limited capacity due to his depression. They argued that being the case, he could not have committed these murders premeditated. So he couldn't be found guilty for first-degree murder. Also, a forensic psychiatrist stated that because of the depression, White had gone from being a health-conscious guy, very fit, to eating sugar and drinking sugary drinks. And this became known as the Twinkie defense. I'm sure you've heard of it. This is where it comes from. Dan White, this actually worked. The Twinkie defense worked. Dan White ended up being convicted of voluntary manslaughter, and he was sentenced to 7 years and 8 months in jail. So the day that he was sentenced, it fell the day before Harvey Milk's 49th birthday, I believe. His friend and protege, Cleve Jones, addressed the crowd of about 500 and let them know what the verdict was. He said he could see the hate in their face, and he began to get concerned that something bad was going to happen. The people started to chant, "Out of the bars, into the streets, out of the bars, into the streets," all through the Castro district. People emptied bars and joined these people in the streets, and they began to walk towards City Hall. Started out with 500, 1,000 got added to that, so 1,500, and then as they walked to City Hall, more people gathered, and by the time they were at City Hall, there were 5,000 people angry and looking for blood. They wanted Dan White's head on a pike. But of course, Dan White was not at City Hall. They couldn't get him. So what do? They basically rioted, and this was called the White Night Riots. They ripped apart City Hall, broke windows, broke shop windows nearby, pulled trolley car wires down, tore apart police cars. It was a bad scene. So the police retaliated by covering their badges and using whatever means they could to beat back the crowd, and they used tree branches, pieces of chrome pulled off city buses, tear gas. They used anything they had at their disposal. After 3 hours, the second stage of violence was a police raid / riot later held in the Castro neighborhood. They injured tons of people in bars. They destroyed a bar called the Elephant Walk, which was a big gay bar at that time. After order was restored at City Hall, which was after 3 hours, San Francisco PD cars carrying dozens of officers headed into the Castro district. Despite orders to be told not to go there, they shouted things like "dirty cocksuckers," "sick F-A-G-G-O-T-S. I don't want to repeat that because it's a bad thing. They shattered large plate glass windows at the bar, and they attacked patrons. After about 15 minutes, the police withdrew and joined other officers who were indiscriminately attacking gay people on the street. This lasted for 2 hours. When the police chief at the time heard about this, he immediately went to the location and ordered his men to leave. Later that night, a reporter saw them celebrating downtown. They were not disciplined at all. Excuse me. So that was the White Knight riots, basically. So it happened first with gay people angry, and then the police officers had their own riot and they didn't get in trouble. Neither did anybody that was involved in the first part of the riots. Nobody was arrested or anything like that. They said not to arrest anyone involved. Excuse me, I'm coughing all of a sudden. So, on October 14th, 1979, between 75,000 and 125,000 people marched on Washington for gay rights. Many of them carried a portrait of Melk and placards honoring his legacy. This was something that Melk envisioned on his own. He wanted something like this to happen, but unfortunately it had to happen after his death, and it ended up becoming a tribute rather than something he was involved in. So Dan White was released from prison on January 14th, 1984. He ended up killing himself shortly thereafter through carbon monoxide poisoning in his garage on October 21st, 1985. So the life, and unfortunately the death of Harvey Milk, brought gay rights to the forefront of American politics and culture. So Cleve Jones, that I mentioned earlier, who was Harvey Milk's protege, launched the AIDS Memorial Quilt. And in 2008, Gus Van Sant made a movie chronicling the last 10 years of Harvey Milk's life in a movie called Milk, starring Sean Penn. Penn won an Oscar for his performance, and the movie won Best Screenplay. That movie is actually one of my favorite movies of all time. If you can watch it, it's on Netflix now. Milk, it's an amazing movie. Sad, but it has moments of hope. The whole message is that Harvey, throughout all the stuff that was going on, he believed in hope more than anything. So that's the story of Harvey Milk and the Twinkie defense. It's a sad story. It shouldn't have happened. Whether it was a hate crime or not, it's hard to say. Could have just been a workplace violence situation. But it robbed the world of one of the most amazing politicians ever, who could have been something more than just a city supervisor. It's unfortunate, but he did end up being more in a way, because he became a galvanizing force for people to make change for gay rights and lesbian rights and trans rights, etc. So he was the catalyst to bring these things to the forefront. So, two recommendations this week. If you have Netflix, definitely watch Milk. It's an amazing movie. It will change your life. You'll love it. Sean Penn, he can play anybody, almost. It was great. So, that, and then also on Netflix and on Hulu, Pose is an amazing show. Watch it. I'm obsessed with it. I hope you will like it. It's great. It's great. So, this week's episode, I'm pretty much done with it. Don't have a title for it yet. But there will be an episode next week, and it will be on time, Friday at midnight. I apologize, mea culpa. I'm sorry. So follow me on Twitter at CoffinCast with a capital C, just one capital C, at CoffinCast. I will be more than happy to talk to you there. I only have 10 followers. I have 10 followers now, but that's a big deal. But also, I can recommend other podcasts if there's things you're interested in. Also, I started a second podcast because I enjoy podcasting so much, but I don't like talking about dev all the time anymore. I need a break from it sometimes. I have another podcast called Single Fat Female. Also on Twitter at Single Fat Femme. I put the episodes there if you want to listen. If you don't, that's okay. It's more of a lighthearted podcast about my trials and tribulations trying to date. So take a listen there. Hopefully you enjoy it. Definitely let me know if there's anything I made a mistake on. Like I say, every episode, let me know of mistakes, updates, how you're doing, what you had for dinner, what you're watching, what books you're reading. Let me know at CoffinCast, capital C. on Twitter. I know there's something I say at the end of every episode. I forgot it. Do I want to stop this and start over? No, but you're going to sit with me while I try to remember it. Life is a dream walking, but death is going home. I'll see you next week. Okay, love you. Bye-bye.